This is Audible.
Castle of Blood by C.L. Werner, read by Claire Wyatt. Prologue. Darkness, heavy and dank, infested the cellar. The blackness stretched across the ceiling, sprawled along the floor, clung to the walls in a thick skein of brooding shadows. The air itself was rank with the absence of light, cold and clammy, as if it was drawn with each breath. There was an atmosphere of lurking menace, the nameless fear that plucks at the heart when midnight crawls across the land. The old man's wrinkled hand closed tighter about the ivory walking stick he held. His bleary eyes stared into the darkness, instinct defying the logic that told him he could see nothing. His ears strained for every sound. He could hear the creep of centipedes as they stalked rats in the dark, the drip of water falling to the cellar floor, the rasp of gnawing fangs as vermin tried to chew their way into boxes and barrels. There was nothing to betray the presence of someone waiting in the room. Just the same, the old man knew it was not empty.
"He of here," he whispered,
his lisp drawing out the words.
"He's here,"
confirmed the trader, who stood just behind the old man on the copper stairs. He drew a long rod of alabaster from his belt and set his palms against either end of it. The middle of the rod began to glow, throwing a bluish light across the cellar. The cellar was a large room, with walls fashioned from blocks of dark iron. The floor was dirt and sparkled with the copper flecks mixed into its grains. Heavy archways supported the high ceiling and the bronze-sheeted roof. Much of the room was occupied by tin boxes and bronze barrels. Rats and centipedes alike retreated from the light. There was one occupant of the cellar who did not retreat. He rose from the crate he'd been sitting on when the trader activated his torch. He was so tall that he seemed almost like an ogre from the savage wilds. And such a comparison was not unjustified. His was a barbarous aspect. His dark skin was tattooed in white, creating a deathly image. His face was stained, teeth inked across his lips, his eyes staring from the sockets of a painted skull. Each bone was picked out in white on his long fingers and brawny arms. He wore a morbid helm fashioned from the head of a wolf, its snout and fangs stretching across his forehead. A breastplate of assorted bones was tied around his chest. A short skirt of skin circled his waist, the withered face of a man whose body had been flayed to craft the garment, frozen in a silent scream.
"This is him,"
the trader said, not without a shudder. The old man limped down the last few steps, leaning heavily on his stick. He knew he was a complete contrast to the barbarian. His body was frail, wasted and thin beneath the velvet coat he wore. Frilled cuffs fell around his shriveled hands, and rings of teak and mahogany circled his fingers. The buttons on his vest were of pure ebony, and the buckle on his belt was of polished cherry wood. There was the smell of rose water on his pale, wrinkled skin. Nothing, however, bespoke the great wealth he enjoyed like the gold-petaled lily that was pinned over his heart. Scarce was the soil vibrant enough to support such delicate growth in this region of Chamon.
"This is him,"
he repeated as he walked down to the cellar. There was no trepidation in his voice, only eagerness. The trader stepped down to accompany the old man. He was middle-aged, his brown hair rapidly retreating from the middle of his head, silver sneaking into his thick moustache. His build was heavy, straying towards a paunch. His crimson doublet was not so refined as the coat of his companion, but there was a gaudy opulence in its flash of embroidered vines and leaves. Everything in his garb was of a similar character, loudly announcing prosperity and lacking the refinement of the old man's riches. For the trader, wealth was an accomplishment to be boldly proclaimed. To the old man, it was a natural birthright.
Thorkmul has journeyed far to bring you what you seek, your illustrious highness, the trader said.
He gave the old man an apologetic look.
I'm afraid the expense I've incurred is more than we originally bargained.
The old man fixed the trader with a steely gaze.
You will be paid, Gustav.
He reached for his belt and untied the leather bag hanging there. Turning his attention back to the barbarian, he tossed the pouch to Gustav.
Money is of little value to me now.
Gustav pounced on the bag and quickly opened it. He grinned as he filled his fist with teakwood coins.
Take whatever you need for your commission,
the old man said as he walked towards the barbarian.
How much do you want?
He asked the tattooed tribesman. Thokmul crossed his brawny arms and returned the old man's gaze. The barbarian's eyes were intense, the pupils tinged a raw and vicious red. The stare of the wolf whose head he wore could not have been more ferocious. The old man could feel the hate, the smouldering rage behind the tribesman's eyes, the bloodlust just waiting to be unleashed.
No money, Thokmul said at last.
His voice was a deep rumble, like the pulse of a war drum.
You cannot buy what I have brought.
The old man reared up, the ivory stick raised to strike Thokmul.
You have brought it, and it will be mine, he hissed.
His aged frame trembled with fury.
You cannot buy what I have brought,
the barbarian repeated. His face pulled back in a cold smile, his real teeth showing beneath those inked across his lips.
It can only be given.
Given?
The old man muttered, his arm still raised to strike. Thokmul nodded.
I do not sell.
He pointed at Gustav, crouched on the floor, counting his coins.
He would sell it. I will not.
Then I will take it,
the old man snarled. The ivory stick swung down at Thokmul's head. The barbarian caught it in his hand and plucked it from the old man's grasp, as though he were but a child. The old man staggered, almost falling onto the floor as he lost his balance. He managed to keep from collapsing by sheer force of will. He would not prostrate himself before a savage from the wilds.
You understand,
Thokmul growled, approval in his tone.
You know what it is you ask for, what it means, how it must be used.
The barbarian tossed the ivory stick back to the old man.
I see in your eyes the same fire that is in mine. You know how it must be used, and you will use it.
It will be used,
the old man hissed as he leaned against his stick once more.
It will be used more than even your bloodthirsty soul would dare.
There is a price, Thokmul warned.
And I will pay it,
the old man said.
Gladly, happily. I have waited 20 years, and now what I want is within my grasp.
His face darkened.
Give it to me, or I will take it from you.
The barbarian glared back at the old man.
It does not matter from whence the blood flows, he growled.
But your god does care how much blood is given to him,
the old man retorted.
Yes, you can kill me. But I promise you that in doing so you will be cheating your god. Give it to me, and your god shall have a feast. I will give him gallons of blood, pools of it.
Thokmul again held the old man's gaze. Slowly, he reached for a bundle of skins resting on the box beside him. His stained fingers pulled away the dried gut that had bound the bundle together. As he drew the covering back, a sinister object was revealed. It was a long knife of bronze, its blade curved like a saber tusk's claw, its pommel shaped into a skeletal visage. An air of evil radiated from the weapon, a miasma of murder and massacre. The old man hurried forwards, ignoring the pain in his aged bones. his lips curled in a triumphant smile. "At last, revenge will be mine," he chortled.
The barbarian took a step back and studied the old man. Thokmul was pleased by what he saw.
"You see, your illustrious highness,"
Gustav crowed from back near the stairs.
"I told you he'd bring the ferba."
He pointed at the sinister knife Thokmul had revealed.
"All I had to do was let the Skullcaller tribe know you are seeking it."
The old man turned and fixed Gustav with a grim look.
"And now you know that I have found it."
Gustav cringed at the murderous tone in his patron's voice.
"We had an agreement,"
he sputtered as he stumbled to his feet, his hands closing tight around the money.
"You were paid,"
the old man sneered, his eyes glittered with malice.
"I can trust you to bring me something for pay, Gustav, but how can I ever trust you to keep quiet about what I have bought?" "You can trust me! You can trust me!"
the trader insisted as he slowly backed away towards the steps. The old man shook his head.
"A man who values only money can never be trusted."
He looked aside at Thokmul.
"I have only just met your friend, but we understand each other better than you can imagine."
Gustav cried out and turned to run. Thokmul's hand had darted for the bone vest he wore. Before the trader could reach the bottom step, his cry of fear became a groan of agony. A bone-handled knife shivered in the middle of his back, thrown across the cellar by Thokmul. The tribesman stalked over to Gustav and ripped the blade free. Coldly, he flipped the wounded man over and plunged the knife into his heart. The old man paid no notice to Gustav's murder. He was too busy winding the skin coverings back around the ferber. He held the bundle close to his chest as he limped across the cellar.
"I will know if you do not use it," Thokmul warned as the old man walked past him.
"You can leave Gustav's body here when you are through,"
the old man said.
"This is where he hid contraband. None of his serfs know about this place. Nobody will find him."
Thokmul twisted his knife, cracking Gustav's ribs. He reached into the trader's chest and pulled out the dripping heart. He shook the disembodied organ at the old man.
"You have made a promise to my god. Khorne will be angry if you break your oath."
The old man laughed, a sound as cold as the hiss of a serpent.
"I've waited 20 years for this. No power of gods or men will keep me from my revenge."
He studied Thokmul for a moment. He was pleased by the uneasiness he saw when the barbarian met his gaze.
"I believe you," Thokmul said. "I think I will leave this place as quickly as I can. I will return to my tribe."
His smile was as cruel as it was nervous.
"I believe your words, and I know the carnage that will spawn from them."
The old man turned away and started up the steps.
"Yes," he muttered. "Death now walks the streets of Ravensbach."
Chapter 1. Magda brought the slim, rakish blade whipping around. The sword slashed across its target, ripping deep into the bloated paunch. Innards spilled out and streamed across the copper-sheeted floor. A smirk of satisfaction teased at the young woman's lips. She quickly tried to correct herself and adopt a more sombre pose, but she already knew it was too late. She had exposed herself and would now suffer the price.
"A lack of focus will get you killed,"
the scolding words rang across the room. Magda turned around and sheathed her sword. She set her hands on her hips and threw back her head in an effort to look defiant. Inside, though, she felt as if a bunch of mice were running around in her guts. However hard she worked, however independent she thought herself, the displeasure of her father made her feel like a guilty little girl caught swiping fruit from the larder. Ottokar Hausler stamped his way across his shop, each step a little heavier than the last. He used his left hand to brush away the belts and scabbards that hung from the beams. The right did not so much as sway as he walked, locked in place at his side. A dark glove covered the right hand, and the sleeve of his doublet covered almost all of the rest.
There was only a little patch behind the wrist that was uncovered, revealing a flash of silver.
You have to concentrate, Ottokar said.
His face was full, just on the verge of becoming flabby. The sharp nose was tinged red and the cheeks were flushed. There was still a keenness in his eyes, but it was dulled by the sheen of liquor. The sound of swordplay could still rouse him from his cups. Magda swept a stray lock of night-black hair from her face and matched her father's judgmental stare. She pointed to the stuffed target dummy she had disemboweled, sand still running from it onto the floor. Unlike her father's, the glove she wore was to better her grip on a sword, not hide an infirmity.
My technique improves every day, she proclaimed. I'm faster and more accurate.
Ottokar waved aside her boast.
Skill is not enough, he said. Discipline. Discipline is the key. You can be fast as lightning, precise as a viper, but still be an amateur with the sword.
He came a few steps closer and then stamped his foot down on the pedal that controlled the target dummy. Magda whipped around, and the blade leapt from its scabbard and ripped across the throat of the sackcloth dummy. More sand rained down on the floor. She started to turn back to her father, only then did she realise that he had stamped on the pedal a second time. The dummy was swinging around, a wooden sword in each of its eight arms. There was no time for her to dart in and strike, and no chance to parry all of the enemy swords. She jumped back and crashed to the floor.
Never let down your guard, Ottokar warned.
My blade crossed its throat, Magda countered. If it had been a man, he would be dead.
She rose to her feet and started brushing dust from her breeches. Ottokar shook his head.
Some men take more killing than others, and the dead do not stay dead as they should be.
He sighed and gave her a studious look.
I would think that your paramour would have told you something about those kinds of things.
It was one barb too many for Magda. Perhaps he was justified in criticising her ability with the sword, but he had no authority to speak about anything else she did. Ottokar had forfeited that right a long time ago.
You surprise me, father. You condescended to take an interest in me.
Magda recovered her sword from the floor and swept it through the empty air. Aside from what I can do with this. The sharp words caused Ottokar to look away. He glanced across his workshop, at the swords hanging on the walls and resting in barrels. The forge and the anvil, the ingots of bronze and iron and steel he would shape into weapons. In one corner, each perched on its own stand, were elegant blades crafted in another time, weapons Ottokar would not allow anyone to buy. They had to be earned, bestowed on those the swordsmith felt were worthy of them. Guilt gnawed at Magda when she reflected that she was one of the few to have been given one of those swords.
This is my world, Ottokar said. This is the only place where I'm any good to anyone.
He reached over with his left hand and gripped the lifeless hulk that had replaced his right. The motion caused anger to swell within his daughter.
Spare me the melancholy, Magda snapped. You lost your arm in a duel, not your life.
Ottokar looked at her, his eyes glittering with emotion.
Were they not the same thing?
Only for someone who cares only about swords, Magda retorted.
You were too young to remember.
Yes, I was too young to know who you were before you lost your arm. That's an excuse I've heard many times, father. I weary of hearing it.
Magda slammed the sword back into its sheath and marched towards the shop's exit.
Do one thing for me, she said as she passed Ottokar. Wait until I've left before you crawl back into the bottle.
Magda could hear her father stamping his way across the workshop while she climbed the stairs that led to the family's home above the business. Briefly, she thought about going back and apologising for her harsh words. She discarded the idea. She didn't have anything to apologise for. She brushed aside the strings of polished tin that curtained off the entranceway and stepped into the little courtyard beyond. Water bubbled from the bronze fountain that loomed over the little pool in the middle of the area. Imitation trees with fronds of painted electrum cast shade over the courtyard. Stone benches were scattered about in the shadows. A few marble-coloured birds flitted about, tweeting at each other with shrill cries. They scattered as Magda walked towards the curtained doorways at the far end of the courtyard. A strong smell of boiling stew struck her nose as she stepped into the long common room. Magda looked towards the doorway leading into the kitchen. She could hear the sound of plates and bowls being moved around. A moment later, her mother emerged from behind the curtain of tin strings. Inga Hausler was not quite 20 years older than Magda, but age had touched her so softly that they might pass for sisters. She was not quite as trim and fit as her daughter, her long legs lacking the corded muscles of her child's, her arms devoid of the strength that characterised the swordswoman. But her face had that same classic loveliness. Big blue eyes and high cheekbones, a soft snip of a nose and lush, full lips. Inga kept her raven tresses loose and wild, a dark cascade that spilled down her shoulders and across her breast. Magda preferred to keep her own hair tied back so that it would not be in the way, but her mother seemed to delight in the disordered abandon of her own. She was often trying to get Magda to follow her example. Inga smiled. "Sounds like practice is over for today." She wiped her hands on the apron she wore over her jade-coloured dress. She arched an eyebrow when she noted Magda's demeanour. "I take it you two had words again. The miserable sot should know better when to keep his tongue in a bottle." As angry as she was, Magda took offence at the disparagement of her father. Even if her mother was voicing her own thoughts of only a moment before, "He means well," she said. "It's hard on him. A swordsmith with only one arm. He has to leave most of the work to his apprentice and put his stamp on blades he feels are beneath his quality. That can't be easy for him." "Ottokar never chose anything that was easy," Inga said, acidly. "Always had to keep proving himself. Never knew when something was good enough. Could never be satisfied to leave things as they were." She shook her head and gave Magda an excited look. "You'll never guess what happened today. A messenger came from Count Wulfsieg von Kurteberg." Magda gave her mother a puzzled stare. "The Count? What could he want with us?" Inga bristled at the incredulous tone. She puffed herself out, taking on the arrogant air she always adopted whenever someone questioned her status. "I'll have you know that we've been invited to dinner at Murgast Castle. All of us are to be Count Wulfsieg's guests." She tossed her head back, the long raven tresses sweeping around her like the waves of some black ocean. "There was a time when I was courted by the Count's son. If things had turned out differently, you might have been a noblewoman's daughter instead of a drunkard's." "But why does the Count wish to entertain us?" Magda pressed. "I don't understand." Inga frowned and stepped back into the kitchen. A moment later, she came out with a thin sheet of copper, upon which had been etched the invitation. Affixed to the bottom of the metal page was the wax seal of the von Kurteberg, a castle flanked by lightning bolts. "Here, since you seem to think I am making things up." Magda read the invitation. It was just as her mother had said. But that only raised more questions. But why? "When good things happen, accept them," Inga advised her. "Count Wulfsieg is one of the wealthiest men in Ravensbach. Can you imagine the spread he'll have?" She glanced back at the kitchen and frowned. "At least for one night there won't be squab stew and beans. Oh, we'll eat like ladies and lords should." "The invitation only says to bring the family," Magda said, reading the page. "There's no mention of how many. Do you think it would be all right to ask Kluger to come?" Inga sighed in exasperation. "Oh, that man is beneath you," she said. "You're a beautiful girl. You can do so much better than him." Colour rushed into Magda's cheeks. First the old argument with her father, now the ongoing one with her mother. "I don't care about better. I love Kluger." "Love," Inga tuttered and shook her head. "How long do you think that will last? The man's prospects are limited. What kind of advancement does he have with those Sigmarite priests?" She looked at the room around them and frowned. "Even the best of them couldn't afford this. You'd be stepping down, not up." "We aren't having this discussion," Magda stated. I'm only looking out for what is best for you, Inga replied. You're still young. You could have any man you turned your attention to. I don't want you to waste your opportunities the way I did. Magda's hands curled into fists at her sides. Before she could think, the words were spoken. I'm not sure you wasted any opportunity, Mother. Inga's eyes went wide with shock. She snatched the invitation from Magda's hand with such force that it sliced her palm. The messenger said to bring my family, she said as she turned and walked back into the kitchen. That man is not part of my family, and he never will be. Magda stared after her mother as the tin strings fell back into place. She truly regretted the horrible things she had said. She knew her mother loved her deeply and was only trying to do what she thought was best. The problem was that what was smart wasn't always what was right. Magda trusted her feelings more than her mother's strategizing. Blood dripped from the cut on Magda's hand. She glanced down at it and the now ruined glove. More than her injury, she was thinking about the invitation. They never did decide why Count Wulfsieg should ask them to dinner at the castle. Bruno Volkenhorst was rummaging in the old iron chest. He couldn't remember the last time he'd even opened it. Was it 10 years ago, or only 5? It had been a long time in any event. So long that as he shifted the contents around, the old cloaks and threadbare hats, he started to wonder if what he was looking for was even there. Maybe he'd got rid of it some time back. It was possible his wife had thrown it out. She'd always been avid about getting rid of what she termed clutter. Bruno paused in his rummaging. A maudlin look fell across his weather-bitten face. Kirsa. It was 7 years since she died. No, if he was going to be honest with himself, he had to face it. Kirsa had been murdered. Stabbed by men who mistook her for him in the dark. Bruno had paid back that debt of blood, but it did little to ease the pain of her loss. After all these years, just thinking about her made his heart feel like a slab of ice. He'd quit the business after that. It was ironic that he still thought of it as his real business, even though he had been legitimate ever since Kirsa's death. Bruno couldn't quite think of himself as a merchant. A humble seller of whatever goods he could secure at a discount. He still thought of it as a front for the merchandise he'd once smuggled into Ravensbach, or the stolen goods he'd fenced for thieves and burglars. Unhealthy people to know, smugglers and thieves, but then they weren't always that way. Not at the start. A flash of gold at the bottom of the box caused Bruno to search faster. He pushed aside the accumulated bric-a-brac and uncovered what he'd been looking for. He lifted the tunic out of the box and unfolded it. The once vibrant blue had faded considerably over the years, but the brass buttons and golden braid were still as smart as the first day he'd worn it. He held the coat against his chest and tried to estimate how it would fit. There might be some trouble getting it buttoned up, but that was to be expected after almost 20 years. So many years. So much time since he'd been the dashing young captain in the Free Guild. Bruno had led men into the wilds of Chamon, pushing back against the savagery that threatened Ravensback. They had battled orcs and beastkin, grot raiders and human barbarians. Whatever the enemy, the Ravensback Free Guild had marched forth to send them back into the wastelands. It was by their efforts that the city had been able to expand, to establish new mines and farms, maintain the trade routes that allowed it to flourish. Bruno shifted through the box and withdrew the cocked hat that accompanied the jacket. Stark white once, it had darkened to a musty grey. The brilliant plume that had been pinned to its side was only a tattered memory now, a raw quill with a few frayed specks of feather. He smiled as he remembered all the trouble the plumes had given him. They became so worn out that he always had to keep a few replacements with him on campaign. He groped around the box until his hand came upon a little bronze case. Lifting it out, he snapped it open and was rewarded with the sight of a long red feather. He'd be able to replace that shabby veteran after all.
Father, are you up there?
The voice came from the apartment below. Bruno gathered up his mementos of the past and started down from the attic. The iron ladder trembled as he stepped down its rungs. Waiting below was a young man with sandy brown hair and a muscular build. His tunic was rough leather, his belt made from the scaly skin of a copperthroat. His breeches were a dun colour, woven from the tough fibres of the webweed. It was the boots, however, that drew Bruno's attention. They were high and stiff, rising almost to the knees, made of oxhide and stained a dark black, except, of course, for those spots that were spattered with dun-coloured mud.
"You've been out with that gang again," Bruno grumbled as he stepped down into the apartment.
The common room was large enough and appointed in a lavish, if outdated, style. He'd always done his best to indulge Kirsa, but he'd seen no reason to indulge himself when she was gone. As for their son, Bruno wondered if he'd indulged the boy too much.
"That gang, as you call them, are my friends," the youth said, annoyance in his voice.
"Berenge, having the wrong friends is worse than no friends at all," Bruno said. "You have to recognise when they've gone bad so that you don't go bad too."
"There's nothing..." Bruno cut him off. "How much did you steal this time? And from who?"
He scowled and walked over to the copper-faced liquor cabinet.
"Never mind. I know you won't tell me anyway. You're young enough to still believe in honour among thieves."
He poured himself a glass of brandy.
"It isn't as bad as you always think," Berenger explained. "We only take from those who deserve to be robbed."
Bruno sank back in a chair. The coat and hat sprawled across his lap. He stared up at his son.
"That's how it always is. How it always starts. Someone you don't like has too much, so you take it from them. Somebody you feel is cruel or unjust happens to be rich. You steal some of it."
"I understand you got your start when you stole provisions from the Free Guild," Berenger reminded his father.
"You must have been speaking with Romuald," Bruno said. "Maybe Markov?" "I'm surprised you've been chatting with their sort. But then I suppose you need someone to fence your goods."
Berenger frowned at the disdain in his father's eyes.
"Are those stories wrong?"
he challenged. Bruno took a slow sip of brandy.
"No," he confessed. "That's how it started. Romuald, Markov."
He paused, not wanting to speak the names of the men who had murdered Bruno's mother.
"A few others. We took bread and meat from the storehouse. There was a famine in Ravensbach. The only people who had enough to fill their bellies were the nobles and the soldiers. That wasn't right. So we decided to redistribute the food among our families and friends."
He again paused and gave Berenger a hard look.
"That's how it starts. Noble ideas and good intentions, but it doesn't stay that way. You toss aside honour for necessity. Then the next time you need even less reason to steal. So it goes on and on until you're right down in the gutter with the rats."
"It isn't like that," Berenger objected. We only take..."
"From bad people, I know," Bruno interjected. "And one day, all it'll need to make someone bad is simply that they have something that you want."
"You don't understand."
"Better than you imagine."
Bruno gulped down the rest of the brandy.
"I see so much of myself in you. It's almost painful. Don't make the same mistakes I made, boy. Keep your head high and your hands clean."
Berenger shook his head. "I need to make my own way. I want to make something for myself. I don't want to just hang around like a vulture waiting for my inheritance. You've given me a lot. Done everything you could for me, but I've got to do something for myself. I've got to do it on my own."
"By stealing?"
"That's how you got your start," Berenger retorted.
It took some time for Bruno to reply. It wasn't anger that kept him silent. It was guilt and shame and pain and regret, all melded into one sickening sensation.
"I did it wrong," he finally said. "I tried to find a shortcut, but there are no shortcuts. Everything has its price,
Some prices are too dire, but you don't always know what you're paying until it's too late.
Berger was quiet for a time, his emotions hard to read. When he did speak, it was to change their discussion entirely. He pointed at the coat and hat resting in Bruno's lap. What made you dig those old rags out?
I'll thank you not to call my uniform old rags, Bruno chided.
He stood up and put the hat on his head, then smoothed out the coat and threw it over his shoulders.
You understand that's never going to fit you, Berger said.
Bruno frowned.
I just need to stuff myself into this coat for one night. That's all I ask of it.
A puzzled look came across Berger's face.
One night? What is this all about?
Chuckling, Bruno walked over to the silver-ornamented table that stood near the entryway. He picked up the copper sheet that was resting there and held it out to his son.
An invitation, he said. You and I have been invited to dinner at Castle Murgast by Count Wulfsieg.
Berger's bewilderment only increased as he looked over the message.
Why would the Count invite us?
We're hardly of a station to warrant such notice.
There was a wistful tone in Bruno's voice when he answered.
That's why I dug out the uniform.
A long time ago, when I was a captain in the Free Guild, I was a friend of the Count's son, Hagen. I think he's feeling nostalgic for old times. The Count must be nearing 90. He probably wants to see people who would remind him of happier times, rekindle old memories.
Berger glanced down at his clothes.
If we're visiting the Count's, I'll have to get something suitable for the occasion. I don't want to be mistaken for a servant.
A bitter memory stirred at the back of Bruno's mind.
I shouldn't worry, he said. To Count Wulfsieg, there isn't a soul in Ravensback he regards as anything more than a servant.
The steps of Baron Roald von Wernher echoed through the hall. A servant in white livery hurried behind the noble, wiping the marks of his boots from the marble floor. The hallway, with its limestone pillars and oak ceiling, was a display of opulence and wealth few in Ravensback could match. Roald was fanatical about maintaining the immaculate condition of this extravagance. No one, even other nobles, was allowed to walk across the polished marble without first putting silk slippers on their feet. The lamps that hung from the ceiling were lit by elaborate devices of Dwardin manufacture, rather than anything that might drop wax or exude smoke. The limestone pillars were coated in a special unguent, an alchemical sheen that prevented fingers from leaving a mark upon them. The doors that opened into the hallway were fashioned from cherrywood and pine, beech and alder, their latches and handles sculpted from lapis lazuli and pearl. There could be no greater evidence of the excitement the message had raised in the Baron than that he should forgo every rule of his household and march through the hall with his boots on. His customarily stern visage was lit by an almost palpable eagerness. In a low whisper, he muttered a single word to himself as he stalked down the hall.
Finally!
Roald rolled the word over his tongue, savouring it like a choice delicacy. He clenched his fingers tight around the copper sheet, as though afraid it would vanish if he lost his grip on it. When his steps carried him to an elaborately carved cherrywood door, his eyes focused on the images of dragons and gods. Sigmar and Dracothion, repeated in different poses on each panel. He had paid a small fortune for that artistry, a gesture meant to impress Ravensback's lector. Well, it seemed he would no longer have to impress anybody in the city. Not anymore.
Open it!
Roald snapped at the servant who had followed him down the hall. The menial scrambled forwards and pushed the portal inwards. The Baron quickly followed him, forcing the man to duck out of his master's path. The room within was richly appointed. Brightly coloured tapestries hung from the walls and rich rugs covered the floors. Sunlight streamed into the chamber from a window that ran the full height of the back wall, some 20 feet from the base to the ceiling. Couches and divans were arrayed around the room, alongside fine sculptures and little tables with bowls of fruit. Nearer to the wall were two chairs, rolled, marched towards these and their occupants.
"It's happened at last," he announced triumphantly.
He waited for his audience to respond. The chair to his right was occupied by a girl wearing a long white dress. Curly locks of blonde hair fell around her lace-covered shoulders. Her cherubic face brightened when she saw Roald, and she set down her knitting to devote her full attention to her father. Seated in the other chair was a woman in her middle years. Her face was lean and aristocratic, in much the same mould as that of her husband. Baroness Hiltruda von Vonher was one of the old blood, just as Roald was. Their families had been the first to bring civilization to Ravensback, after the storm cast swept away the barbaric hordes of chaos. The von Vonhers were an old peerage and a proud name, so much so that Roald had surrendered his own title to adopt his wife's. Hiltruda's current attitude was a reminder of that fact. She did not look up when Roald spoke, but just kept working at her knitting. Roald waited. Normally he would wait as long as it took, but not today. Today he was going to demand Hiltruda's interest.
"Confound you!" he barked. "This is important!"
"Do not be so dramatic, Roald," the Baroness countered. "Nothing you can say could be of the slightest importance."
Roald pounced on her dismissive words like a hungry wolf.
"Not important? Confound it, woman! Put down that blasted knitting and listen!"
The irritation in his tone, or the persistence of his intrusion, finally made Hiltruda look up. The instant she did, he thrust the message in her face. He laughed victoriously as he watched shock and wonder play through her expression.
"Is it something good, Papa?" the blonde-headed girl asked.
"Better than good, Liebgarda," Roald boasted. "Better than your best dreams, little one."
Hiltruda leaned back in her chair and pulled at one of her mahogany earrings.
"Can this really be?"
"You can see the Count's seal right there at the bottom."
Roald stabbed his finger at the blob of wax and the impression of a castle surrounded by lightning.
"What can it mean?" Hiltruda wondered.
"Mean? Mean? Why, it means that what I've worked towards all these years is finally going to be mine."
Roald looked out of the window and watched the gardeners working in the luxurious flower beds. He despised flowers. Of all the extravagances he'd invested in, he'd found them the most insipid. But now he no longer resented what he'd spent on them, what he'd spent on anything, because his name had spread throughout the great and powerful of Ravensbach. His position had grown in such stature that even Count Wulfsieg had taken notice of him.
"An invitation to dinner at Murgast," Roald said. "An invitation to all of us. We are to dine with the Count as his guests tomorrow."
"But what does it mean?"
Hiltruda persisted. A cold smile crawled across Roald's patrician features.
"Count Wulfsieg is old. So old it is a wonder he isn't a Geist. He has no family, no heirs to carry on his name or inherit his wealth."
His eyes gleamed as he looked at his wife and daughter.
"Don't you see? The Count needs an heir. That is why he is asking us to the castle. He wants to make me his heir."
Hiltruda was more guarded in her estimate.
"Why should he give you what you have schemed and plotted to steal from him all these years? I know you think you are clever and hid your tracks, but maybe the Count is even cleverer."
Roald laughed at that.
"Clever! Clever! The old fool never leaves that damn castle. He's kept himself locked away in there for decades. Half of Ravensback thinks he's already dead, and it is just his servants maintaining the illusion that he's alive so they don't lose their jobs. Trust me, Hiltruda, he couldn't be more obvious if it was an ogre shopping for drapes."
"You're always so certain of yourself, aren't you?"
"When I set my mind to something, I get it," Roald told her. "Though sometimes it's not quite what I thought it would be," he added with a sneer.
"This could be one of those times," Hiltruda warned.
She directed his attention back to the invitation. Roald read the sheet again.
You notice it is not made out to Baroness Hiltruder von Wernher, but to me, he said. It is not made out to Baron Roald von Wernher either, Hiltruder said. This time it was her tone that had a ring of triumph to it. Roald looked again. For an instant it escaped him, and then he finally understood what he'd glossed over in his reading of the invitation. It wasn't made out to Baron Roald von Wernher and family. It was addressed to Baron Roald von Rodian, his name before marrying Hiltruder, a name he had not used in 20 years. Chapter 2. No one in Ravensback was unaware of Murghurst Castle. Built upon a high hill that overlooked the city, the ancient fortress was visible from every quarter. Its iron shadow lay across the land like a shroud, a whisper of death. Its ragged parapets stared down at the streets below with a grim judgment, a merciless gaze in which all were found wanting. The central tower, its roof edged in long spikes, clawed up into the sky, blood bats and carrion crows nesting in its battlements. When the carriage started to ascend the winding path that led to the castle, a chill of fear closed around Magda's heart. She had never been this close to Murghurst, and now that she was, all the stories from her childhood came flooding back into her mind. The children of Ravensback often challenged one another to climb the hill and touch the castle wall. Many claimed to have done so, but they would ascend only far enough to be out of sight of their friends and duck behind one of the jagged rocks that lined the path, waiting until enough time should pass until they could return and claim to have accomplished the dare. Certainly that was what Magda had done when put to the test. Now she was going to actually enter the sight of those childhood fears. It was strange how Magda had thought herself beyond such foolishness until they were almost at their destination. She looked across the carriage to where her parents sat. Neither of them appeared uneasy in the slightest. Her mother looked excited, eager to be the guest of so wealthy a man as Count Wulfsieg. Her father wasn't anxious either. He was slumped against the door, his face flushed and his eyes closed. Magda could smell the bilious liquor on his breath every time he exhaled. Inga glanced over at Magda and rolled her eyes. "I know," she said. "Your father couldn't even stay out of the bottle for one night." She looked over at Ottokar and reached across his body to tug at the sleeve of his shirt. It had hiked up quite a bit and exposed several inches of the silver arm. As she did, her fingers struck against the hollow metal and sent a sharp sound ringing through the carriage. The noise awoke Ottokar, who spluttered and swung his bleary gaze around the carriage.
"Are we there already?"
"We're going up the hill now," Magda said. Ottokar drew the drapery that hung over the window further back. Magda could see the steep drop on that side of the path. A matter of less than a foot, and the carriage would be careering down the side to be smashed to splinters on the rocks below. A shudder swept through her, and she could feel the colour draining from her face. Ottokar was not so drunk that he didn't notice his daughter's anxiety. He quickly closed the curtain.
"It will not be long now," Inga said, settling back in her seat. "I rarely ask much from you, Ottokar, but this one time I expect you to not embarrass me, just for tonight. Try to be a man and not a sot."
Ottokar didn't respond. He just turned and stared at the closed window. It was Magda who attempted to defend him.
"Mother, you asked us to come. Father is doing his best."
Inga sighed, long and deep.
"No, he hasn't been at his best for many years now."
She gave her husband a look that was at once both pitying and scornful. She turned back to Magda.
"Count Wulfsieg invited all of us, the whole family. You don't ignore a summons like that." "I still don't understand why he invited us."
"Listen," Inga said, holding up her gloved hand. She gestured with a lace-covered finger.
"Do you hear them?"
Magda strained her ears. She could hear the rattle of their coach as it climbed the hill, but it was curiously echoed. She thought it might be some trick of the rocks throwing the sound around, until she faintly heard a horse neigh somewhere below.
There are other coaches.
There are other coaches, Inga said, her face glowing with pleasure. The dinner isn't just for us. Count Wolfsieg is hosting a banquet. She clapped her hands together like a little girl. Oh, the Count used to hold the most magnificent parties. Everyone of any significance at all was there. In those days, the Hauslers meant something. Your grandfather made blades fit for kings. My family, they were the richest goldmongers in the city. Oh, the feasts back then. There'd be music and dance long into the night, as sometimes it would take first rays of dawn to put a finish to the merriment. Count Wolfsieg hasn't left the castle in decades, Magda reasoned. Why'd he suddenly decide to host a banquet? He's very old, Inga said. He has no children, nothing to make him look ahead to tomorrow, so all he has are his memories of the past. Maybe he was thinking on the past and remembered the lavish parties he once held. Maybe he decided to relive those times. Everyone of consequence will be there, she told Magda. The best families and their sons. You must be on your best behaviour. Make a good impression. Inga frowned as she studied the understated blue dress Magda wore. I do wish you'd taken one of my old gowns. You need sugar to catch flies, you know. I'm not interested in catching anyone, Magda reminded her mother, hoping they weren't going to argue on the subject again. She returned Inga's gaze, evaluating her mother's low-cut gown. The shoulders were bare and the neckline plunged. The waist was drawn tight against her curves, so much so that Magda wondered how her mother was going to walk, much less dance, in the garment. It seems to me you've got more than enough bait on display. Inga ignored the barb and pressed on with her attack. You can do better than Kluger. You should do better than him. If not for yourself, think of your children. What kind of life can a man in his profession... Whatever else Inga might have added to her argument went unspoken. The carriage lurched to a sudden halt. It shuddered as the coachman dropped down from his seat and walked to the door. As he opened it, Magda felt a shiver rush through her. They were in the courtyard of Murghast Castle. Iron walls surrounded them on every side, rising 40 feet from the flagstones. Magda looked back at the massive gate and the steel portcullis that rose above it. Its sharpened ends seemed like fangs hanging over the gateway's gaping maw, as though at any moment it would bite down and swallow those inside the courtyard. Magda stepped down from the carriage and turned her eyes towards the keep. The building was as grim as the outer walls, a fortress of blackened iron. Gargoyles leered from the battlements, their mouths crusted with corrosion. The windows that peppered the imposing façade were all narrow and recessed into the edifice. The tower rose above everything, a spindle of metal ringed with savage-looking spikes near its summit. From the very peak of its roof, a banner snapped in the wind, a red field with a black castle flanked by golden lightning bolts. Murghast was more than cheerful back then, Inga said as she climbed down from the carriage. She pointed to the many iron eagles that jutted from inside the walls. Those haven't changed, though. I could never shake the impression that they were watching me. Following her mother's direction, Magda gave the sculptures closer scrutiny. She was surprised to find that each eagle was slightly different. Perhaps that was what accounted for their eerie, lifelike aspect. It did feel as though they were watching. More than watching. They seemed to be judging. They're unsettling, aren't they? Magda jumped. She spun around, her hand flying to her hip where her sword would be. Of course it wasn't there. Inga might not have got away with squeezing Magda into one of her old gowns, but she had been adamant that her daughter wasn't wearing a sword to a formal dinner. The young man who had spoken took a step back, surprise in his eyes. You must be quick, he said. It depends how you mean that, Magda said coldly. The man removed the fur cap he wore and bowed his head. My apologies, I didn't mean to startle you. He smiled and nodded at the iron eagles. To be honest,
I'm just happy to see I'm not the only one who finds those things creepy. Magda looked him over. He was around her own age, handsome in a kind of rakish fashion. His clothing was respectable, if not overly opulent. Gold buttons on his vest, silver buckles on his boots. He had an ebony ring on one finger and she realised she was acting like her mother, evaluating people based on their appearance and how much wealth they displayed. She looked around the courtyard again. There were a few other people there, obviously guests who had arrived before the Hauslers. She saw that her mother was speaking with a man wearing the coat and hat of a Free Guild officer. He bore some resemblance to the youth who had surprised her. Magda noted with annoyance that the officer had worn his sword to the castle.
"Who says I find them creepy?" she asked, perturbed.
"I think you'd need to be one of Sigmar's chosen not to shudder with those things watching you," the man replied. He punctuated his statement with a dramatic shiver. Such was its ridiculous excess that Magda couldn't help but laugh.
"I'm sorry," she said, and extended her hand.
"Magda Hausler." The man took her hand and bowed. "Birger Volkenhorst." His expression became thoughtful, and he glanced at the gloved hand he held.
"You... forgive me for saying... but this is the wrong hand."
Magda's cheeks turned crimson as she withdrew her left hand from him.
"I'm afraid this isn't quite... I mean... this isn't the sort..."
"It's all right," Birger said. His expression still showed a marked curiosity. "This isn't my kind of thing either. I'm not really accustomed to society, as it were."
"Then this time it's me who is relieved to not be the only one," Magda said.
She pointed to the man speaking with her mother.
"Your father? He looks like an officer."
Birger nodded.
"He was," he replied. "That was a long time ago," he added hurriedly.
His eyes still had that curious look in them.
"Forgive me if I'm being impertinent, but the way you offered your hand, that's the way duelists greet people. And, well, it seemed when I startled you, you were reaching for a sword."
Magda could see her mother looking over at them. There was an imploring sternness in her expression.
"Bad habits I've picked up," she said. "Not terribly ladylike, I know."
"Of course," Birger said, snapping his fingers.
"Hausler. You must be the daughter of Ottokar Hausler, the swordsmith.
Why, I've heard that he could not only make the finest blades, he could use them too." The youth looked around the courtyard, obviously searching for her father. Magda took Birger by the arm and indicated the man he was looking for. She could actually feel the disappointment run through him, like water draining out of a water skin. Ottokar was leaning against a short stone wall. Despite Inger's attentions, his coat was rumpled and the sleeve of his tunic was pulled back to expose part of his false arm. As though to draw further attention to his disability, Ottokar was wearing a left-handed sword belt.
"They still tell stories about the time he was ambushed by the Carver brothers," Birger said. "Just his sword against 5 murderers out for his blood. And it was only your father who walked away."
He turned his head and smiled at Magda.
"It's going to be an honour to break bread with a man like him."
"Thank you for saying so." Magda knew the words were pretense, a courtesy to salve her own disappointment. Even so, she appreciated Birger's sympathy. Another coach was drawing into the courtyard. Magda waited while the coachman opened the door for the occupants. A young man stepped out, his doublet and hose finer than anything either Hauslers or Volkenhorst could afford. After him emerged an older woman with a pale complexion and deep, haunted eyes. She was followed by a man in flowing robes. The dark blue garb was edged in gold and embroidered with curious symbols and figures. The man's face had a dark, mysterious quality to it, his eyes fierce and commanding. His black hair was slicked back in a widow's peak, and when he gestured to the coachman, Magda saw that his fingers were long and sinuous, moving with an almost boneless fluidity.
"Lothar Krebs," Birger muttered, uneasiness in his tone.
He saw the bafflement in Magda's eyes.
"The alchemist," he added. "I've visited him on occasion.
Perhaps my mother's right. Maybe all the people of importance have been invited to the castle."
Banga quickly turned away when Lothar looked in his direction. Shall we go inside? I'm sure the interior must be more comfortable than out here. Magda was rather doubtful on that score. As her eyes turned to the keep's entrance, she